application or calendar 06-235 and 06-310. Sarah Anastasia Olenix versus Jack Andrich, M.D. Ms. Sheehan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michelle Sheehan, and I represent Dr. Jack Andrich of the Cleveland Clinic. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time. We're here today, Your Honors, to ask this court to enforce the rules of civil procedure as they are written, not to interpret additional language into the rule, specifically Rule 41A. The purpose of Rule 41A is to allow a plaintiff one opportunity to dismiss and refile their claims. How a plaintiff chooses to dismiss their claims is up to the plaintiff. But we know Rule 41A provides three opportunities or three methods for a plaintiff to dismiss their case. They can do it by notice, they can do it by stipulation, or they can do it by court order. In fact, as I mentioned before, the rule specifically delineates these three methods. And this court has created legal precedent in Freisinger versus Leach that recognizes the three methods a plaintiff can use to dismiss their case. The issue for this court, then, is what is the effect when the plaintiff uses a combination of those methods to dismiss their case? What happens if a plaintiff asks a court to dismiss their case, it's dismissed, they refile, and then the plaintiff turns around and files a notice of dismissal and refiles their case a third time? Well, the rules of civil procedure provide an answer for this question. The rules provide that if a plaintiff has already dismissed their claim, then a refile, a notice of dismissal that's subsequently filed is with prejudice. The operative language, in fact, reads, a notice of dismissal operates as an adjudication upon the merits of any claim that the plaintiff has once dismissed in any court.
But counsel, had the plaintiff dismissed more than once an action against this particular defendant?
Yes. The plaintiff in this case had requested the court to dismiss the case. At their request, the court did that. Under 41A, that would be one dismissal by the plaintiff.
No, but Dr. Andrich was not included in that, correct?
No, Your Honor. The first filing was against the Cleveland Clinic and its employees. The second filing was against the employees, Dr. Andrich specifically.
He was named in the second complaint.
Yes, he was named in the second complaint. The first complaint identified the Cleveland Clinic and its privies. The second complaint identified him specifically. So, in this case, that claim, the plaintiff's claim, was dismissed twice. First by court order, second by a notice of dismissal. The rule does not state that both dismissals must be by notice. That is where this issue has become muddy. We have many lower courts below have consistently misinterpreted the rule to add a requirement to say that both dismissals must be by notice, but that's
not. Is Judge Gallagher wrong when, at the end of his opinion, he said, we note that Civil Rule 41 was written to abolish the broad liberty given to plaintiffs under 23-2305A, which allowed plaintiffs to dismiss any number of times so long as the statute had not run. See Civil Rule 41 staff notes. In order for the plaintiff to obtain more than one dismissal under 41A1B, and A2, Civil Rule 41A1B and A2 require that the plaintiff convince the defendant to stipulate to a dismissal and or a court agree to order a dismissal without prejudice.
So he's
citing the staff notes to the adoption of the rule indicating that if the parties stipulate or if the court orders the dismissal, that doesn't count.
I believe the staff notes are consistent with our interpretation that.
So the judge is wrong when he cites the staff notes?
No, I wouldn't say the judge is wrong. I believe the staff notes and what Judge Gallagher cited is correct in the sense that the staff notes discuss the three methods of dismissal, and they discuss the effect of those three dismissals as you look at each type of dismissal individually. The issue here is how it happens when those types of dismissals are used in conjunction with one another. And the rule provides that...
So if your client had agreed to the previous dismissal, even though your client wasn't a party to the previous case, is that correct? Your client was not a party to the previous case?
Our client was it was an employee of the Cleveland Clinic and identified. If your question was if we had agreed.
If you stipulated under two to the first dismissal, would that still count under your theory?
Yes, that would still count. Because it is a dismissal, and recognizing a defendant never has an opportunity to dismiss a case without prejudice. That's never an opportunity of the defendant. The plaintiff can choose how to dismiss
but
the case.
Say you're getting ready for a trial and both lawyers agree this case just isn't ready to go. It's in the interest of both parties to dismiss. Maybe it's even, let's say the defendant is the one that approaches the plaintiff and says, you know, we've got problems. Would you stipulate to a dismissal and a refiling? That would count under your theory.
That would count against the plaintiff, and that's plaintiff's decision if he wants to dismiss his case for the defendant. Conceivably, a plaintiff could have multiple stipulations for dismissal 3-4 times. That's just the way the rule provides. Same with the court. The court could dismiss a case without prejudice multiple times. But that's plaintiff's decision. And plaintiff doesn't have to stipulate under those circumstances. But that would count against them. In fact, that's why we had suggested that the proper terminology for this rule would be the last dismissal rule, not the double dismissal rule, because you're looking at the last dismissal. Was it a notice of dismissal? Was it with or without prejudice? If it was a notice and it was previously dismissed, then it's with prejudice. We need this court to address how many times does a plaintiff get to dismiss a case and refile? Currently, as I mentioned, there's a conflict in the lower courts. They've created a loophole that allows a plaintiff to repeatedly dismiss and refile. And we're asking this court to close that loophole.
How many times can a plaintiff file and dismiss now?
Under the current lower court's interpretation, a plaintiff can repeatedly file, dismiss.
No limit.
No limit. The only limit that's in being interpreted right now is if there's two notices. So there has to be two notice of dismissals. Otherwise, the plaintiff can repeatedly...
No, that's not true, is it? The question was, how often can the plaintiff dismiss? Twice. Under the Eighth District's interpretation. Would that not be the correct answer?
No, that's not the way I would interpret the Eighth District decision. The plaintiff can repeatedly dismiss and refile, depending on how they do it. They can, like you mentioned before, Your Honor, have multiple stipulations.
If the court dismisses, and if the court dismissed more than once, that wouldn't count the way the Eighth District's interpreting it.
That is correct.
If the plaintiff dismisses twice, isn't that the way they interpret the rule?
Well, I think that's where we disagree on how when you say the plaintiff dismisses. The way I read the rules, any one of those three ways, the plaintiff dismisses. But if it's a notice dismissal, then yes, I would agree that the plaintiff can only file a notice of dismissal once. The second dismissal would be with prejudice. So
counsel, if the court summarily dismissed based on a need to control its docket, for example, that's counted against the plaintiff?
That would not be. That would be a 41B involuntary dismissal, and that does not count against the plaintiff.
So you say when it's precipitated by the plaintiff, whether it's on motion or notice or a precipitated stipulation, that's all going to count against the plaintiff in your reading?
That would count against the plaintiff, and that is how the rule is written. 41A provides voluntary dismissal. effect thereof. 41B is involuntary. So there's mechanisms within the civil procedures, the rules of civil procedure, to allow a court to dismiss under the circumstances you described without it counting against the plaintiff.
So basically, you would have us write a rule of law that states that there is no distinction between a notice dismissal, a motion for dismissal, or a stipulated dismissal.
If it's filed under 41A. The goal here is
how would it not be filed under 41A?
Versus, like you mentioned before, a 41B by
well,
court dismissal.
Well, that wouldn't be precipitated by the plaintiff.
Right. As long as it's a 41A dismissal under those are the three mechanisms under 41A. The goal here is to have one bite at the apple, not multiple bites at the apple. And this, while isn't a perfect solution, would get more to the goal or would drive more to the goal that there's one chance to dismiss and refile, not multiple opportunities like what happened here with let's file a motion with the court, ask the court to dismiss, then turn around and file a notice, have it dismissed, and then file again and keep this case going on.
Although, counsel, the language you quoted earlier, unless otherwise stated in the notice of dismissal or stipulation, the dismissal is without prejudice, except, and there's this exception, except that a notice of dismissal operates as the adjudication on the merits of any claim that the plaintiff has once dismissed in any court. It seems to suggest that there is a distinction among those three methods.
And that's where I would just respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor, because the rule, as you just quoted, is written under the section dealing with both stipulations and notice, but it does not say that the plaintiff has once filed a notice of dismissal in any court. It could have, it didn't. It only says that the plaintiff must dismiss, and this court has already said there's three ways for the plaintiff to dismiss under 41A, by notice, stipulation, or by court order. So the rule could have said that the plaintiff has once dismissed by notice, but it chose not to.
Ms. Sheen, may I ask you to come back to the issue with respect to party dismissal? Your case would be stronger if you were representing the Cleveland Clinic because they've been defendant in two cases, am I correct?
Actually, in the facts in this case, Your Honor, it's a very creative way it was done. The first lawsuit was against the Cleveland Clinic and its employees, identifying John Doe doctors. The second case was against the employees of Cleveland Clinic and specifically identifying those John Doe. So the Cleveland Clinic was not a party to the second lawsuit.
Well, was your client identified as a John Doe defendant in the first lawsuit?
Yes, we believe he was identified as an employee that provided medical care to them as a John Doe. Was his name specifically identified in that first complaint? No, but the allegation was against the Cleveland Clinic and its employees that provided care and a John Doe physician that provided care. So, and as the plaintiff pointed out in his briefs, res judicata applies to those claims against the same parties and their privies. This is a case where it involves the privies between the Cleveland Clinic and its employees. Our doctor was identified in the first case and in the second case.
Counsel, does it make any difference, do you think, to the analysis that initially in 1997 this case was filed on behalf of the minor and then 5 years later when the victim, the plaintiff, attained the age of majority, pursued an action in her own right?
I do not believe it makes any difference. The first lawsuit was filed on behalf of the minor, as you stated, and her parents. There's plenty of case law that says that parent is just stepping into the shoes for that child. So it's as if that child filed that lawsuit the first time and the second time. So I do not believe there's a difference. Again, as I mentioned before, we've asked this court to close the loophole we believe exists in the civil rules and apply the rules as written. We're also seeking some finality for Dr. Andrisch, who's had to deal with this claim for over a decade because it has been repeatedly dismissed and refiled. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sheehan. Mr. Files.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is David Files. I'm here on behalf of the appellee. I sat here and listened to the questions you asked, and they're pretty much the ones I would have asked. So the only couple of things I'd like to mention, and then I'll answer any questions you have. And other than that, I won't take any more of my time. While the issue that this court asks us to discuss in this appeal deals only with the difference between various sections of Rule 41, I want to make sure the court, and some of you have mentioned it already, it's very important that Dr. Andrish was not, in fact, a party to the first litigation. And in fact, the Jane Does that were named in a copy of that original complaint is attached, starting at page 21 of the appendix to my brief. It mentions John Doe and or John Doe MD Inc., person and or entity who provided medical care and treatment to plaintiff Sarah Olnick, a minor, during 1996 and or 1995 or 96. Says nothing whatsoever about employees of the Cleveland Clinic, absolutely nothing. The only people that were named individually were other defendants, doctors who at that time they knew had treated my client. Apparently at the time, and again, I was not involved in that, there were other attorneys, they did not realize that Dr. Andrews had actually provided services to Sarah. Whether or not that's the case, I don't know.
Mr. Files, how many times do you think a plaintiff can file, dismiss and refile this lawsuit?
Once is all, because the second time it's with prejudice, if he files a notice. However, this court has recognized in Freisinger, in fact, I would submit Freisinger is determinative of this case. This court recognized the difference between the two and the fact that only A1A is the only one that gives unfettered discretion to the plaintiff to dismiss without anybody else checking him out. But once they do that a second time, exercise that unfettered right, then it's only fair that that's with prejudice. But when we're talking, and as this court said in Freisinger, with stipulation, the other party controls. The party doesn't want to stipulate to a dismissal, they don't stipulate. Plaintiff has no control over that. The same thing with the court. And in fact, I've been involved in situations where I asked the court to dismiss, and the court refused. Says, if you want to dismiss it 41A1. Mm-hmm. One of you up there mentioned, I don't remember who it was, that situations where when the parties get together and decide that, you know, they're really not ready to go to trial, a judge says, this has been on my docket for 2 years. It's going to trial. It's over and done with. I'm not going to delay this any longer. So they stipulate to dismiss under 41A. Two, or 41A, 41B, I'm sorry, 41A1B, yes. Again, the plaintiff does not control. There are many circumstances that come up during a trial or during a case in court that prevents being tried at the time it should have been tried from a time standpoint. And all this does, all Rule 41 does, is give the plaintiff one bite at the apple, that's it, or two bites at the apple. First time, dismiss by notice. But if they dismiss again by notice, then they're done. And that's only fair. And this court has recognized that in Freisinger. All of the other cases, they have not cited a single case to the contrary in this state, other than Besicum. I assume that's the way it's pronounced. That's the only one. And even that one is just dicta. That was not a ruling in the case as such. For this court to change it now at this point in time would be, in effect, an amendment of the rule. And if the court wants to, and maybe the court feels that's the way it should be, that nobody should ever get more than twice. That's it, file once, dismiss, or dismiss in any manner, you can only file it once more. Fine, if the court decides that, but let's do it the proper way by amendment of the rule, not by construction, which is inconsistent with the plain language of the rule. But the important thing here, again, is whatever you decide on that doesn't make any difference. My client never dismissed prior any claim against Dr. Andrish. He was not a party. They can twist and struggle as much as they want. They can't make him a party to the original complaint. Now, how can he benefit from that? Now, if he was an employer, and we had sued, the original one had sued an employee of his, then he could claim, yeah, he was, by implication, a party because he was responsible for his employee. But that's not the case. He wasn't an employee of Cleveland Clinic, in fact. He was an independent outside doctor who treated patients at the Cleveland Clinic. The rule itself, just on a plain reading of the rule. Now, I'll grant you, maybe it says, where rule 41A1B says, except that a notice of dismissal operates as an adjudication upon the merits of any claim the plaintiff has once dismissed in any court. I'll acknowledge that it could have been drafted a little better. No criticism. As it said,
it could have been drafted better.
The plaintiff has once dismissed by notice. That had been very clear and there'd be no question. They're hanging their hat on has once been dismissed. But it nevertheless, it says where the plaintiff has done so, all right? Claimant has done so. A plaintiff doesn't dismiss. It might ask a court, please court dismiss. It might go to the defendants and say, oh, come on, guys, stipulate to a dismissal. We can both clean it, maybe get this settled. Many times that's happened also. You're talking settlement, but you can't get it resolved before trial day. So you agree and stipulate to a dismissal. And if it doesn't, however, settle, then you go ahead and refile. If this court makes this rule, all those uses are out the window. They adopt a defense argument. Any other questions I can answer? If not, I don't really feel I have anything else to that you would benefit from.
Thank you, Mr. Piles.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Sheehan, you saved 30 seconds.
Your Honors, the only thing I would...
Counsel, before you get to your point here, we seem to have a difference of opinion as to the status of this doctor. Was he an employee of the clinic, or was he a practitioner utilizing the clinic?
Absolutely, he was an employee of the clinic, and in all the record and pleadings to date, it's been stipulated he was an employee. And in fact, their original complaint was an allegation provided at all times the medical treatment provided to the plaintiff was done through various agents and or employees of the defendant Cleveland Clinic, and as such, the Cleveland Clinic is responsible for the acts or omissions of its agents and or employees. Absolutely, he was an employee. There's no question. I'd also just like to add that this is not an amendment to the rule. This is enforcing the rule as it is written. It's easy to interpret this rule to assist the plaintiff's attorneys, because that's the easy way to do it. But we're not here to make things easy. We're here to enforce the rule as it's written. And I would ask this court to take a hard look at the language as it is written and enforce it as written. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sheehan. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of your opinion.